Hey everybody, welcome back to the Blister Podcast on the Blister Podcast Network. I'm Jonathan Ellsworth, and you can check out everything we're doing and reviewing over at blisterreview.com. Well, today on the podcast, I am having a conversation with the person who actually is pretty much responsible for the whole creation of Blister, my very good friend, Michael Clark. For a couple years now, Michael and I have talked about recording this conversation together, and I am currently visiting Michael and his wife and family out in Arizona. And so we thought, well, this is the time, this is the occasion. Let's record this conversation where we talk a bit more about the origin story of Blister and how this whole thing has evolved over the last 13 and a half years. And I've certainly talked about some of the principles behind Blister and elements of the origin story in some other places. So if you never miss an episode of the Blister Podcast or Gear 30 or something like that, well, then there's a good chance you probably have heard a good bit of this already. But we also have really grown the Blister community a lot over the years. And so I suspect that for a good number of you, there's going to be a lot of details that you haven't heard before or haven't heard them fleshed out too much before. And so, it's kind of a brief-ish history of Blister today with one of my best friends who, well, as you're about to hear, I may have misunderstood in a conversation back in 2010, and that then changed the entire course of my life and led to sort of this thing we call Blister today. And so with that, let's get to this conversation about Blister and Michael Clark's interview of yours truly. Here we go. All right, well, I am here at the home of my best friend since grad school. And as we're going to get into, seriously, the person behind the existence of Blister, we will explain in a minute. I'm here with Michael Clark. Michael, good morning.
It's good to have you here.
Thanks. We've talked about doing this for a while. Interestingly, when you first proposed it, maybe there was a bit of a tie-in to when you first brought up the idea of creating a gear review company. Maybe neither of these things you thought would actually happen, or that I would take you up on it. But this is it. We're here. We're doing this.
Let's do it.
Okay. So let's talk about the origin story. And you just handed me the literal receipt. This is quite a historic document, at least, you know, for me. Well, you have come to multiple Blister summits now, and you know, and you are tired of this, I also know, but I always introduce you to people like, this is my buddy from grad school. This guy is literally responsible for the creation of Blister. And so let me sort of open by sort of giving my recollection of this, and then you can, oh, by the way, this is probably a good enough time as any. If anybody just heard that noise in the background, that would be your tortoise Mortimer trying to get in to this casita we are recording in. I think we probably should just talk about Mortimer most of the time here.
Mortimer would clearly like to be part of this conversation.
Mortimer probably doesn't really have a personal attachment to me, but he does seem at least, at a minimum, extremely curious and wondering if I might have more lettuce on hand to give him. But he does seek me out a lot, and this has brought a lot of happiness into my recent life.
Mortimer came with the house, so he feels clearly at home here.
I think we do need to talk about the fact that, like, first of all, yeah, you bought a house and it came with a tortoise. An African spurred tortoise, I believe.
African sulcata. Yeah, we found out after we purchased the house that there was a tortoise in residence.
Tortoise in residence. And we've been talking about the fact that I think, you know, as part of our fast-paced modern lives, there's something really, really wonderful and therapeutic about having a prehistoric creature just roaming around the premise constantly.
I think that's true. They, I'm not really an expert, but have learned that they predate the dinosaurs as a species, not this one in particular. And it's just, you know, something that's been here on this planet for unfathomable, you know, eons.
Yeah.
And still just kind of doing its thing.
Yeah. And the thing I've been reflecting on the last couple of days is like, why does everybody have a dog or cat and very, very few people comparatively have like giant tortoises? I am now convinced that there should be at least as many giant tortoises out there, you know, in people's homes and backyards as there are dogs and cats. I think this is a real missed opportunity.
I'm a fan.
Yeah, big fan. Me too. All right, back to the origin story. Let me hear your take on this. Like, when I say that you are responsible for the existence of Blister.
I did the easy part, which was propose something that was far less extensive than what Blister became.
Okay, go on.
You had a business before Blister.
I mean, I wouldn't to call it a business. I'd call it a hobby.
So why don't you say more about what was White Room Skis?
White Room Skis, yeah.
Because I still have a White Room Skis sticker on which you put on a pair of skis in my in the garage here.
Yeah.
So tell what was White Room?
Yeah. White Room Skis. So basically the year was probably, I don't know, 2008, 2009. I'm in New Mexico, you know, skiing Taos a bunch, and I was just getting more and more and more into skiing and the gear and the rest. And at the time, whatever the kind of mainstream ski media was doing, you know, they were covering the stuff they were covering, but there were all of these really interesting indie ski companies, Moment Skis, ON3P, Praxis, DPS was, you know, coming up the ranks. And when I would go to Taos and ski with my friends and, you know, just see what people were on, it honestly at the time struck me as like, you got a really, really passionate ski community, a bunch of rippers, but nobody was really on what I thought were some of the really interesting skis from some of the interesting companies coming out. And I was like, well, that should change. I can still hear Mortimer trying to come in and join us. It's awesome. It's the first time the podcast has been interrupted by a giant tortoise. So that's, I'm a big fan of like firsts. And so here we go. We just got a first. So anyway, I was like, well, I just wanted to have some skis around that literally kind of my friends in the community could get on and check out and sort of be like, yo, like the ski world and ski gear is changing, right? Some of those indie companies were doing wider skis, more heavily rockered skis, right? Newer shapes, widths, etc. And I just was like, y'all should check this out. And so I kind of set up this was never ever like going to be some big business thing. Very much based out of the garage, but I wanted to get some friends basically on some like what I thought were interesting new products in the ski world, including you. And I foisted this on you.
You did. You had at that point in time got me on a pair of Line Profit 90s, which were and for me, that sort of opened my eyes at the time to what you just described, which all these new, mostly American companies doing some interesting experimental things with skis, and that some of them could make what I thought were world-class skis.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, we should say a bit about your own ski background.
So I grew up skiing in Colorado, and so when we were talking about what eventually became Blister, I had just gotten back into skiing after a bit of a hiatus in Chicago. So it kind of overlapped with your interest in skis, and I want to talk a little bit more about how you came to that. Sort of overlapped with my getting back into the sport after 5 or 6 years of not skiing a lot.
And I mean, you grew up skiing in Colorado. You skied at CU Boulder, right? And then you and I met in grad school at University of Chicago. And that was maybe the Venn diagram where neither of us, where I was not real, I'd skied a couple times in my life, basically. But so we didn't do a lot of skiing. We never skied, not once, our years at U of C together. So anyway, and then I was about to embark on my, let's say unconventional journey into the ski world. And yeah, you were about to be getting back into that world that you grew up in.
Yes.
Okay.
That was accurate.
Okay. So it's funny. I don't remember that, like when I got you or told you get on a pair of Line Profit 90s. But so I'm guessing that was probably around 2007, 2008-ish.
Sounds right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But then, we're going to fast forward a little bit. So I start White Room Skis, again, as a hobby to get some friends on some more interesting skis. And then this is the physical receipt that I have in my hand. We will take a picture of this. It was July 3rd. I love this because it was Independence Day weekend. We are having some beers in New Mexico, and on July 3rd, 2010, you say to me,
you were talking about your White Room skis, and I had said, you know, you should, I was really just thinking about content marketing. I was like, but I was thinking like, look, there are all these interesting new ski companies. There's not a lot of information about them. You go to like most ski shops and it's still, you know, the big ski companies, big, mostly European ski companies. How are people gonna, you know, how do people learn about what's going on and understand like what does reverse camber mean? Mm-hmm. What are the, you know, what are some of the different materials being used? Why should it matter? And you had of course opinions on these things,
yeah,
already. And so I had in mind, you know, that you'd cover reviews like a kind of tech reporter. What I didn't anticipate is you kind of taking the whole Walt Mossberger model and starting a whole media company focused on reviews.
Oh, so I like misheard you, basically.
I was thinking this would be, you know, like a thing on the White Room Ski website where you'd be like, what is reverse camber? Let's just jettison the whole business that you were working on at the time and just make the blog the business.
Yep. Yeah. So those are some of the fun, like happy accidents of life. Right. And it would be even better if you were like, no, I wanted you to make one blog post. That was it. That was my only idea. Maybe, you know, I think we were probably drinking Marble Brewing Company's Double White.
That sounds like a plausible.
Yeah, because that was kind of my jam at the time. So I was probably on like my second Double White. And those are, if I remember, it's like a 7%, maybe 7.8%. So maybe I was two or three deep into some Double Whites. And that's why, when you're like, dude, make one post. And instead I was like, apparently Clark thinks I should start an entire media company.
And it was hazy. It was definitely a lost in the haze of time, that discussion. Mm. I think people would be interested in hearing about how you came, you know, taking a step back. You had mentioned, you know, when we first met in Chicago, you were not a skier.
No.
And I would imagine that most people coming to this podcast or to Blister, you know, would think, oh, you know, Jonathan grew up in ski country. He's been into outdoor sports his whole life, but that's not true.
No, not remotely.
And in fact, when we met, you had skied. You'd skied.
I'd skied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you were not you would not describe yourself as a skier. I knew you as like,
not.
What was your, well, I knew you as like you were playing basketball and I know you had a history of football.
Yeah. 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 No, that was,
so you were athletic, but not outdoor sports.
Yeah. Yeah. I, grew up in Chicago, football and basketball, as I often say, that was kind of my entire world. And that was it. And yeah, did those things at a relatively high level. But the first time I ever skied was my junior year of high school. I went one time. I definitely skied in jeans. And I had no idea whatsoever what was supposed to happen when you like put on these boots and clicked into bindings. And I remember vividly the very first run I ever took on a pair of Alpine skis, because we were skiing. It was something like, I forget if it was like, I probably won't even get the name right, like Devil's Head in maybe Wisconsin, or it was, I think, an area in Wisconsin or Michigan, maybe Alpine Valley. But like, it would be amazing to go back to some of these places, by the way, you know, a lot of years later. But anyway.
Amazing is doing a lot of work there.
Well, I think I'd probably love it. But I remember getting off the chairlift. I don't think I fell down. I think I made it off the chairlift without like wiping out. But we kind of, you know, came around the corner and we were standing. I didn't know the name of these things at the time, but we were standing on top of a mogul run. And I have been given zero instruction by anybody about like what one does on a pair of skis. It's kind of amazing. It's like if I was like somebody who's never driven a car and you're like, turn the key here, you'll start, and then like have fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's basically where I was. So I'm at the top of this mogul run, which I didn't know they were called moguls. And I didn't know that you were supposed to turn around them. And so I drop in and I just start straight lining directly over them.
Some expert skiers do that.
Well, but there was no like cool Olympic style, like slight knee, you know, deflection left, right. And so I went over maybe the third or fourth mogul and I'm just picking up more and more speed. And then I utterly like launch and land in a spectacular yard sale. That was my first run ever on skis. And I remember thinking like skiing is really hard. And, you know, so that I don't remember anything about the rest of the day. I was probably, come to think of it, I definitely was not wearing a helmet. So yeah, maybe I was pretty concussed because I don't remember anything about the rest of the day. So that was day one. I went back again senior year, one day of skiing. That was day two. And yeah, we're way more concerned about playing in like state championship football games and that kind of thing. Then as an undergrad, and this is an important part of the story, freshman year as an undergrad, I remember there was some guys on my floor who I'm still great friends with today. But it was, we were coming up on MLK junior, 3-day weekend. And, I was like, what do you guys want to do for this 3-day weekend? And a buddy of mine, Jamie, shout out to Jamie Milligan. Jamie was like, well, my folks have a place in Summit County. I had no idea where Summit County was. And, is like, we could go skiing. And somehow I ended up agreeing to go. Actually, I drove us. So drove from the Chicago area out to Summit County all through the night. That was my next time skiing. Those guys, Jamie, Les, I'm going to name, you know, call you out here. I still didn't get any instruction on like what I was supposed to be doing. But anyway, those guys got me out to Colorado. Over the course of those undergrad years, I don't know, I maybe went skiing 15 times, maybe 20 total. And then we straight to University of Chicago, where I was not doing any skiing.
So how did you get from, you know, skiing a handful of times, mm-hmm. To having opinions on new emerging skis, yeah, and ski companies?
Yeah.
Over a relatively short period of time.
Yeah. As you know, grad school, there was some grad school drama that included me wanting to change a dissertation topic. And so there was, I was at a position where I was, you know, probably going to leave University of Chicago to go follow a professor to a different school. And I had a summer to kill, basically. And I was getting pretty claustrophobic in Chicago. Love you, Chicago, still do, but was feeling pretty claustrophobic. And my grandparents, at the end of their lives, had moved out to central New Mexico, Bernalillo, New Mexico. And I had strong memories as an eight-year-old having gone out into one of the most expansive kind of open landscapes, you know, that I had known or ever seen in my life. And so I was like, well, I have a summer to kind of just write and basically buy time. And so decided I'm heading back to New Mexico for a summer. That was in 2002. And then turns out I proceeded to be there for 16 years until I moved to Crested Butte. And it was at that time, and I think an important part of the story, like football and basketball had been my world. Those were cut short. College careers in both football and basketball were cut short because of a pre-existing injury, pretty serious one I'd had back in high school. And I thought it was fascinating as I moved to then northern New Mexico and started meeting people who were like, I mountain bike. And I was basically like, yeah, I don't really even know what that is. I trail run, I climb, right? The whole outdoor community, that was all happening. And I was starting to meet more of those people. And I remember being like really struck by the fact that even if you're the best football player in the world, and let's say you do go to the NFL, 95% of those players, their careers are done by the time they're 26, 27, 28. And I'm like, wait a minute, you can mountain bike your entire life. You can ski. These things that people are as passionate as I was about football, basketball, you can do that forever and you don't get it cut off at, you know, by the time you get kicked out of the NBA or NFL. That's your best case in those sports. That was because of the trauma, frankly, that I felt when my career as a football basketball player was cut short. That made a massive impact on me. And so I pretty quickly in 2002 started mountain biking, climbing, doing some trail running, and then ended up deferring. And was like, yeah, I'm not at all ready to go back into the city. And so I ended up being out in New Mexico for my first winter in 2002, 2003. And that is when I got reconnected with skiing. And I don't know, that first winter, maybe I did 20 days. And it wasn't like instant, you know, but got to the end of that season, went back into mountain biking and climbing and that stuff. But probably by that second season, I was really getting excited and, you know, to get another ski season under my belt. And then it was that year, so probably 2003, it was like, okay, what is this gear? Like, you know, and I started to try to learn more about that. And, you know, we're like obsessive types, right? I think it, like, speaking to the people listening to this podcast, which means they are among the Blister audience, you know who you are. Like, it is a curious lot, who people who are not afraid to dive down rabbit holes. And I started in on that a little, and pretty quickly was like, it, you know, started to learn more about the gear then. But then also, like, I don't know, I probably did 60 to 70 days that second season. And by the third, we're at like 100+ days. So 2004, I'm probably hitting 100 days a year. And there's like, we're off and running in terms of just skiing, not knowing everything in the world about gear or trying to, but like, that's when the skiing, like, this is what I
took
do.
Off, yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you develop it's one thing to do a lot of skiing. It's another thing to develop a sense of how different equipment skis. Because to do that, you have to ski a lot of different equipment. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one thing to have, you know, okay, this ski's a little bit different than this ski. But you've taken that and pretty early took that to a whole different level of, I almost think of it as, you know, you hear about like a wine critic or something.
Yeah.
And to be, you know, to do that, you have to have drunk hundreds, if not thousands, of types of wine to just be able to compare them. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember them. Mm-hmm. And you have to have, you know, reference kind of skis and so on and so forth. So how did you go from, I'm a guy that likes to ski a lot, to having a sense of the gear itself?
Mm-hmm. You know, honestly, in the early days, I was a pretty good kind of mainstream sports athlete, right? Football, basketball player, you know. Now I'm coming to these outdoor sports that I don't know the first thing about. So there's some athleticism there, but I don't know anything about them. So I was certain that getting on the right skis would help me progress as a skier and, you know, make me enjoy this stuff more. And it's funny that you mentioned the line Prophet 90. I remember being on some skinnier non-rockered skis and on these powder days, right? All these skiers talking about pow days, this is the best thing ever. Well, not if you're on the wrong skis, right? And I remember struggling in some of that stuff. And I remember going and buying the Line Prophet 100. And I don't remember what year that was, but maybe 2008-ish. And it was like, oh, 100 underfoot, fat ski, this is gonna be sick. And I remember actually that day on that ski, I was at Ski Santa Fe on a probably 18-inch pow day. And I kept going over the bars, and that ski was submarining and tip diving on me. And turns out, if anybody looks at that, goes back and looks at that Line Prophet 100, it had basically no tip and tail rocker. It was 100 underfoot. So this is where, like, what the media outlets were saying about these products and what the manufacturers were saying about them at the time was not remotely matching up with my experience. And I just dropped whatever I spent, $600 on that ski. And I'm like, wait, this sucks. This is not what I thought I signed up for and purchased with my own money. The next example of that, so I go back, I'm doing more work. I want a damn good pow ski. I'm hearing a ton about the Armada JJ. 115 underfoot, you know, lots of tip and tail rocker, you know, ironically a tip shape that I now really don't like. Weight overly tapered tip, but I was like, okay, this is going to be the thing. So I get on that. Remember my first pow day on that ski was in Taos, and freaking same thing is happening. Tip diving, submarining the tips, going over the bars on that. And I'm like, wait a second, this is not at all supposed to be happening. This is supposed to be this amazing pow ski. What I had no clue of at the time was mount points. And nobody really talked much about this stuff, I think, before we started Blister. That JJ is an amazing ski for some people, but it had a really centered mount point. And if you're not hitting backcountry kickers or jumps and looking to spin that thing a bunch, if you're a directional skier looking for a great pow ski that just keeps you floating, you don't want to have a ski that's got a -2, -3, -4 mount point in a lot of cases, right? And so that was two skis I bought with my own hard-earned money that were letdowns for what I was looking for. But it was not subtle. Like when you're going over the bars and can't get down a damn mountain because there's too much powder, that is not some subtle little experience, right? And I think at that point, I was like, okay, I don't trust these media outlets. I don't trust what the manufacturers say about their products, or they're not giving us enough information. And that started me down the road of like wanting to get on more things. And again, so timeline, I think we're talking, that's 2007-ish, 2008-ish, you know? And I'm doing 100 days a year at that point. And at that point, it's like starting to borrow skis from friends. You know, I'd made friends at a number of ski shops. They were letting me take certain skis out, you know, and I kind of just started going down that road. Also buying a bunch of used skis, probably off of eBay or something, to just try to get on more stuff because I loved this sport and didn't like what some of the gear, how some of the gear was working for me.
So you were very much at this point in time a... You're thinking of the ski industry and the outdoor industry more broadly. You are an outsider.
Oh, 100%.
Like, you didn't come from, you'd never worked in the industry. Nope. You weren't like at a ski company or you weren't on a ski team.
No.
You're this guy skiing in New Mexico.
There, you could not be more of an outsider than I was.
So how did you make your way into this industry? And as you did, you know, what were some of the surprises? Because you kind of already talked about like not hearing about mount points and, you know, some of the ski reviews, but it seems like in having conversations with you over years, like what's spurred a lot of the thinking about Blister was surprises that you as an outsider saw or observed or felt as you started to learn more about this, not just the sport, but the industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first one is, again, I've described my own experience with some of these skis that I'm buying, and I'm told this is the sickest POW ski, best thing ever. And then that's just not my experience. And I didn't totally know exactly why that wasn't my experience initially, but like it was, again, not subtle. So as I'm just still that skier and mountain biker, trying to figure out like what freaking bike or what skis or what boot should I be in? And I can't seem to get good intel on that. Well, I remember when I was talking, and I think, frankly, this was actually during the White Room skis, like year or however long that thing lasted. I was talking with, you know what? I was talking with Marshall Olson, who at the time was at DPS. Now he's the founder of Heritage Labs. And I was saying something to Marshall about, I just read this review in a buyer's guide from one of the sort of mainstream ski media companies. And I'm like, their description of this ski is 100% false. Like that is not remotely like what that ski actually does. And Marshall very casually was like, well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's all just like pay to play. And that stopped me dead in my tracks. I was like, excuse me, what? And he's like, yeah, I mean, you know, it's just like all these companies, they kind of do ad deals with media and like they just, whatever, they just blather out some stuff. It doesn't actually really matter because it's just part of an ad package. That absolutely like knocked me back again, because I'm like a dude spending a lot of time on snow now trying to find this information, buying skis like the Lime Prophet 100. Not that it's a bad ski, but for what it was supposed to do, it was not the right tool for the job. Same thing with that Armada JJ. So I'm blowing money over here and then having a bad time on the mountain. And this is because some of the review outlets aren't being honest about the product. So that was completely scandalized by that. And I was like, you know, again, as an outsider coming into these communities, I was like, this is, you're just lying to me. But that means you're lying to the whole community of skiers and mountain bikers and climbers, et cetera. And I'm like, that's complete bullshit. And it was literally that then, and this is frankly, maybe what I was telling you on the 3rd of July in 2010. And I was like, I can't believe this is how this entire industry kind of operates, at least in general. So that really spun me out. And I don't remember if you then were like, we'll start a blog. Maybe not, because you just wanted one article on reverse camber, I guess. But I was too double whites in. But at that point, I was like, look, I'm a complete outsider. But I had done a decade of incredibly rigorous thinking and writing with the philosophy and lit background. And I was like, okay, well, what happens if I just start, again, off your prompt, I start writing about skis and snowboard. Well, I wasn't writing about snowboards, but the day we launched Blister, we had a snowboard review from Justin Bob. We never were just skis. We were skis and snowboards and climbing gear and mountain bike stuff. So I'm going to recruit some of my sharp friends who are passionate, they care about this stuff, and we're just going to start doing the best we can to accurately describe the pros and cons of this expensive gear. And I had no idea what would come of that. And I knew that I could write at a high level. And to your question of like, how did I start getting decent at detecting the nuances of what a ski does or doesn't do well, like kind of like the wine critic analogy, I think that was some reps. And I think there probably is, like, you know, to some degree, there's like you maybe kind of have it or you don't. And I think you can get better at that. I'd like to think we all have gotten better at that. So there was probably a bit of a native ability there. And I also was pretty comfortable communicating clearly via writing. So anyway, that led it. But it was Blister probably, when I say like you are the reason Blister exists, that, and as scandalized as I was to hear about that, in a lot of cases, advertising revenue was driving the coverage that companies were or weren't getting of skis and bikes, et cetera.
Yeah. So fast forwarding 14 years.
yeah.
Is damn. So you've made a journey now from, you know, outsider to, I don't know if you're an insider, but you're certainly well known and regarded within the industry. How have things changed in terms of information about equipment, you know, veracity of that information, and so forth? Hmm. You know, I obviously Blister now exists, mm-hmm. But what's your kind of sense of the just overall way in which manufacturers, media outlets, and so forth, social media is now a force? What the sort of overall information ecosystem looks like. Like, if you were coming in now, what would be some of the observations you'd have about, you know, what's working, what's not, what's true now that wasn't then, and vice versa? What's changed?
Well, one of the things that's certainly changed from when I was... we have, again, the receipt, the 3rd of July, 2010. By the way, so we went from that conversation to I launched Blister, I believe it was January 25th, 2011. I do not waste time, apparently. Because that was the first conversation, July 3rd, and then we are 2010, and we are launching. We are live January 25th, 2011. But, you know, I think at that time, print media still was a much bigger player than it is, certainly than it is today. And it's actually saying that out loud is almost hard for us to remember, I think. Right?
Yeah, I mean, you were in Santa Fe, which was the home, maybe still is the home of Outside, right? So which was the, and they were
Juggernaut, yeah.
Yeah, the Juggernaut, but there was, you know, of course, Powder, Ski, yep. Skiing.
Yep. Yeah, so those, yeah, that's right, yeah. Outside was down the road. Their headquarters were down the road. Powder was busy being Powder, and Ski Magazine, the rest. And so, man, thinking about that makes it even a little more audacious sounding that I was like, screw all of them. Like, and I have said this consistently over the years, there's some nice writing that was happening in places like Powder and Outside. But when it came to the gear, I was like, fuck all of you, because you are all on the same program of lying about this shit or not actually doing your two run bullshit ski tests and then saying whatever you were going to say, often the regurgitated product copy from the manufacturers. But again, it didn't matter because it was actually about the ad deals for these companies, right? So at the time, I just, I was like, I hate this so much. And, but it was just about the gear. I mean, there were some really good non-gear related articles happening from some of these companies. And
there's an alternate universe, by the way. Like, I don't know if I told you this. I was, right before I went to University of Chicago, Ski Magazine had moved to Boulder,
mm-hmm.
which is where I was. And I had, been offered a job there. And then I turned it down because I got into University of Chicago and I went out to grad school. But there's like an alternate universe when you were, that you would have been like, we would have met, but you would have been like, oh, Clark's that guy writing those terrible reviews.
Yeah, we would have been mortal enemies. That's amazing. I don't know. I just was like, I was obsessed and was hell bent, certainly. And I just did. It was that belief, like, I mean, and dude, when I started Blister, and I've mentioned this, the first 2 years I literally worked 120 hours a week. I worked till 5 a.m., went to sleep for 4 hours, got up at 9 a.m., and I did that 7 days a week for 2 years. If I tried to go back to that program now, I would be dead in like a month. But I just was like, we're just going to outwork everybody. And there was enough faith in that, well, I was like, we're going to switch this game up. And I'm coming for their heads just on the gear review front. I didn't like anything about the way that these papers of record were giving information to their most passionate people, their friends, literally, like our friends, our community of skiers and the rest. And, you know, faith in a seed, to, you know, steal a phrase from Thoreau. It was like, we're just going to try to outwork everybody and we're going to tell the truth and we're going to take no advertising money from any of the gear manufacturers, because that was such a dominant revenue stream for all of the bike companies out there, or the bike media companies out there, the ski media companies. They were making the vast majority of their revenue from the gear companies that they were reviewing. And I was like, that is a fundamental problem. It absolutely is in conflict with any of the integrity of the reviews. And so we're just not going to do that. And I mean, that was frankly one of the craziest decisions, because I was like, we don't have any revenue streams, like at all, which is why I was working 120 hours a week. And, but yeah, so there was a lot to kind of, there's a lot of reasons this should not have worked, but a lot of startup companies can tell that story, that there's dozens of reasons why their business idea shouldn't work. But a thing I'm really proud of is here we are coming up on 14 years later. It kind of has worked, and we've never compromised on the revenue streams. So the integrity of our reviews is still intact. We've never played with those conflicts of interest, and that's a hell of a feat, you know. And I am really proud of that, and I'm really proud of our team and the people that we've been fortunate enough to work with today at Blister, and those who've contributed over the years. That's hard. That's really, really hard, and you know, and it's not super easy now, but you know, we've been managed to make it go.
Yeah, I'm glad you touched on that, because people think of Blister as a media site that they go to and reviews, but obviously there's a company behind that. Mm-hmm. And you've built that company over the last 14 years. What would you do? Is there anything you'd do differently about building that company? If you could send a message back to yourself in 2014 about, or 2010 about starting Blister,
yeah,
other than don't do it, invest in NVIDIA.
note to self. Yeah. Buy some Amazon stock. And there's a thing called NVIDIA. You should go look into it.
Yeah. Other than that, what kind of message would you send back?
Well, at the time, I was literally a philosophy professor, right? I was a philosophy professor who went to New Mexico, and then I was like writing academic philosophy papers, but also became a personal trainer and was like training the governor of New Mexico and still giving talks at philosophy conferences. I have a weird life, and skiing like 100 days a year. So like, I also don't come from a business world, right? And, you know, sometimes when people give that, they ask like, wait, so you did 5 years undergrad, double major philosophy lit, then 5 years of grad school in philosophy. And now you do the ski stuff and bike stuff. Do you ever wish you had studied a different thing? Answer, not once ever. Because I really do think I learned how to think hard, write well, and think creatively, like recognize opportunities or recognize weaknesses in arguments, right? And I will be an advocate for like rigorous studies of the humanities because of that. And I think because of that, I am happy to say I don't look back and think all these things like, oh, this was a massive mistake. What I often say is, I didn't have it all mapped out. We're going to make revenue exactly this way and all of that, or this is going to really go and then it maybe doesn't. You know, there's all that stuff. I think that's part of like any business. But the thing I'm proud of is we had really clear principles intact. And in fact, you can still today go read our Blister Manifesto. And it is 99% the same as it was the day we launched it. Like, we created a podcast avenue, and so we kind of added a little language about we're, you know, looking to elevate the state of conversations in the outdoor space. But the principles were intact, and we never veered from those. And so in terms of what I would do different, well, I'm glad we never veered from those principles. I would have been able to now go tell naive me in 2011, like, that revenue stream might not be as promising as you think it is for this reason or that reason. But I think that is the stuff that kind of the micro pivots that come up in the lifespan of probably any business. Yeah. The other last thing I'll say is I never thought it was going to require the massive effort. And I've heard a lot of founders talk about this. Like, if I would have known then.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe the answer is you wouldn't send a message back.
Don't. Yeah. It's better to leave younger me alone. It's been a monster effort. And, I did not imagine, that it would, require that. And yet I jumped in, I guess even when I launched it, when we launched January 25th, 2011, I didn't even know then that it was going to require a monster effort, but pretty quickly I could see what it was going to take. And then it was like, oh crap, I better run faster. Actually, I need to run faster. Oh, actually. And that's when it was like, holy shit, I don't have time to sleep if this is really going to go. And so that realization happened pretty quickly. I'm happy to report that I don't think it was like, oh my God, don't do this. You're heading for disaster. And one of the things I will say, and then I'll stop on this, I am proud that we have avoided like the kill shot, but I am happy to assume that somebody smarter than me or whatever could have like done all of this and gotten where we are today more quickly. I'm honestly not prepared to say that, oh, we've optimized out and, you know, we have been as completely efficient as possible to get Blister where it is, or somebody else, give them 14 years and this thing could be, I don't know, 10 times bigger than it is. But what I will take credit for is I think we have avoided the kill shot, and we have avoided pursuing small or short-term gains that would ultimately have like fundamentally compromised and messed up our founding principles.
Yeah, the most important thing is not blowing up, right?
Yep. Stay alive one more day. Yeah, I totally believe that. And that's why when you see companies like taking massive amounts of venture capital, that's like, to me, some companies have to do it because they're super capital intensive. But man, that to me feels like you just don't want to do the hard work of really figuring out what works, what the market is, and the rest. So just get a bunch of money, spend it recklessly, and let's hope for the best. And we see companies all the time blowing up that way. And that's fine. But to me, it's like, how committed were you actually to the community you were trying to serve? And that's another thing I'll say is looking back at the 14 years of Blister and who works with us now, this has very much been a thing. The way we've operated is something I can absolutely wake up and say, hey, to the ski community, to the bike community, et cetera, we've really done our best to try to serve you and give you something good that is trustworthy, et cetera.
Switching gears a little bit from the thinking about risk at a corporate level to risk at a personal level, you'd mentioned earlier how you had a bad injury when you were younger playing football, and certainly know you've had some injuries.
Yeah,
skiing, mountain biking.
Yeah,
I love that you've switched from what is probably one of the most dangerous sports, football, but to
the other.
You didn't move to golf,
no,
or tennis or something. Yeah. You moved to other sports that are not necessarily the most the best things to do if you're trying to avoid an injury. So how do you think about that? How do you think about risk in the back? Well, not even in the backcountry, just on the just as you're skiing, as you're mountain biking, certainly if you're in the backcountry, but even just on the front side, how are you, given the number of days you're skiing, but also how important it is to your, you know, your company, your livelihood, you know, your colleagues are out there skiing all day, got people on mountain bikes, like how do you think about either personally or professionally as you think about, you know, your reviewers? And so how do you guys at Blister think about staying out of the hospital?
Well, I'm not that great at that. It turns out, you know, and I think it, like, just coming back to these communities, kind of outdoor sports in general, there are risks. And, you know, I feel like I pretty much really learned how to ski and then really came up skiing in a place like Taos, known for its steeps. I then jumped from Taos to a place that has even gnarlier steeps. And so, you know, and that's the stuff we like, right? And you know, this, like, I absolutely do not think of myself, I hate the phrase, like, adrenaline junkie. That doesn't resonate at all. But I do think about, let's compare it to, you know, New Mexican food and New Mexican green chili or red chili, like that spice factor, man, that keeps life interesting, you know? And just like with a good green chili or red chili, sometimes that spice level goes off the charts and it really rocks your world. But life is boring without some element of spiciness. And I think and it's all relative, and I think that's one of the fun things. So a much better mountain biker than me would find the stuff where I start getting like, oh, this is pretty spicy. They're like, no, it's not. You know, and then there's other people I might ski or bike with where my spice tolerance is much higher than theirs. It's all relative. But I think these are the things that they do certainly keep these sports interesting. I have talked about, I love those moments of, we'll stick with the metaphor of spiciness. Like, I'm not a meditation guy. I don't meditate. But when I drop into a line, a steep line where it's like, you better have your stuff together on this, that is when I am fully present and the rest of the world melts away. And I cannot overstate how mentally significant that is for my own well-being. And so, you know, on the like, well, how about you just do, say, take up golf or something? It's like, well, one, I'm not going to do that anytime soon, at least, because I do love these sports. And those moments of being fully present, whether it's on a bike, whether it's on a pair of skis, that recharges the batteries for me in a way that is incredibly powerful. And yeah, if I wanted to break fewer bones or something, maybe I should just adopt a meditation practice, or I don't know. But so I don't know. This is the stuff we love and it's what we do. And I think a really fun thing about these sports is we get to, some days you can decide, I want to really push myself today. The next day you might be like, I want to keep it completely laid back and super chill. And we get to modulate with those things. The irony when it comes to injuries, very rarely in my life have I been hurt doing the gnarly stuff. And this is the thing, you know, this is the thing we try to communicate, is like, accidents often sneak up on us, injuries sneak up on us when we're not expecting it. And maybe it makes sense when I'm at my most dialed and it's like, if I don't hit this one left-hand turn, I actually might die. Well, turns out that's never happened to me. I've had bike rides where I was done with the tech part of the ride, literally riding back to the road. That's when I probably lost focus, twitched a front wheel, ended up, in my case, 3 years ago, breaking 4 ribs, blowing up my shoulder, you know. So I don't know. I mean, this is the stuff we do. It's the stuff we love. We do try to be responsible, but we realize there is a freedom in these sports that I think we all love, where it is kind of dialing up or dialing down that spiciness level and keeps life interesting.
So you had mentioned earlier what attracted you to outdoor sports in the first place was that you could keep doing it.
Yeah.
And there, you know, there was a great article in, I think it was the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago about the Alta Ski Club, the Alta Over 80 Ski Club.
Huh. Yeah.
And you can apparently ski free at Alta if you're 80 or over.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's awesome.
Big crew of folks that do that. So thinking about skiing for the long term, mm-hmm. and you know, if you want to be skiing, if one wants to be skiing at 80,
yeah, absolutely,
and on, how do you think about risk in with that kind of longevity perspective, in the sense of, okay, you know, do I dial back some things now in order to, you know, maybe I'm not going to you know, ski bumps as aggressively because I want to preserve my knees, or, you know, maybe I'm not going to do, maybe I'm not going to like push it in conditions that are suboptimal so that, you know, more days down the road. Do you make any of those kind of trade-offs, or are you starting to think about those trade-offs?
It's funny. I'm thinking about, was it the very last day of the ski season this year at Crested Butte? It was either the second to last day or the last day. And we were skiing a lap. We came down Cesspool, one of my favorite runs at Crested Butte. And I, for the first time in my life, was kind of exploring the right side of this little zone to the right of Cesspool. And there was this like incredibly seductive section of untracked powder where you kind of had to straight line through. And then there was a jump between two pretty tight trees and nobody had hit it. And I was like, it just looks real nice. And so I hit it and I was with a couple, Jack, I know, was with me. Katie was with me. Shout out to them. But was coming out real hot out the bottom, and like definitely was out of control. Like coming out hot. If there were firm moguls under this beautiful, seductive, untracked snow, like I doubt I could have kept it together. And it was really fun. It was cool. But like, I don't like those moments anymore where I am absolutely out of control in the bottom of a runout. And those kinds of things, like I think about this past season, I wasn't in that position a lot, yeah. You know?
Like I think about your example right there. Like this last season I had two wrecks, both of which were pow days where I was skiing down and hit a firm mogul run under the powder, yeah. That are a bunch of moguls in the powder that I didn't know was there. And, mm-hmm. you know, so kind of going from skiing pow to smashing headlong into a mogul, which has me now like going, okay, I need to know the terrain better. If I'm, mm-hmm. you know, or I need to know, yeah. like, okay, yeah. like, especially if I'm in a, you know, a place I haven't skied in a couple weeks, yeah. or whatever, have a better sense of the conditions before I just go charging down an area where I'm not sure what's under the snow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think in general, and like, look, Crested Butte is a techie, steep place with lots of surprises if you're in the right area. And I don't, you know, I look at, you know, there's so many young rippers in Crested Butte. It's ridiculous. And I have one person in mind, I will not name him. And that guy just goes blind all the time. And like, I don't ski that way anymore. If I'm on a new line and I haven't seen it, been there yet, I don't trust the place. Again, when we're talking about into some of the particularly steepest, gnarliest sections of CB, I don't just assume everything's going to be fine on the ground. And, you know, so I don't know, it's all kind of relative. I'm probably less cautious than some people, way more cautious than others, but I think about that. And one of the things I am very clear on, I do want to be skiing into my 60s, 70s, 80s. And, you know, and so there, that's part of the calculus, but things also happen. I mean, on a whole other side, on the backcountry side of things, I am extremely conservative when it comes to like backcountry conditions, yeah, extremely conservative. If it's touchy at all, I will not be there. And, you know, people have a wide range of tolerances on that front, and I respect that. Again, that freedom that I think we all crave and love about these sports. But from a personal point of view, I will not play on that front. I'm happy to wait. Just go ski the ski area and wait till I feel very good. And even when you feel very good, things can still go south in the backcountry, right? But on that front, I would say I am just absolutely not out there in touchy conditions, and you know, in the backcountry, that's not a risk I'm interested in dealing with.
You've name checked a few people in this podcast. Mm-hmm. How, and some of them are friends of yours from college and other places. How do you think about how you've been very good about maintaining, from what I can tell, going to the, just knowing you, but also going to the summit where a lot of your older friends show up.
Yeah.
You've been good about maintaining long-term friendships, which I think is a talent. How do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I think you're right about that. Well, not the talent part, but I have exceptional friends, and some of them, you know, Steve Buss, my guy since eighth grade, and I still talk to Steve all the time. He's still one of my best friends. You know, shout out also Shan Willis, guys from eighth grade that I'm in touch with all the time. I consider that less, I don't give myself credit for that on as a talent. I consider myself extremely fortunate on that front. You know, that I have had really smart, fun, compelling, interesting, engaging people come into my life, and a lot of them. And in that sense, you know, it's not hard because you want to be connecting with these people. And in case we haven't pointed out dates, you and I met in 1997, which is wild to think about, over half our lives ago, you know, and you're a smart, interesting, fun, compelling person. And I consider myself absolutely fortunate that I have met so many folks like that. And you know, there is not enough hours in the day to stay up with everybody all the time. And I also am well aware, acutely aware of that, painfully aware of that. But, I don't know, man, it's one of the absolute richest, best parts of human existence. I think if you're fortunate to have a number of people, in your life that are up to their own stuff. And a number of my friends don't care about the same things I do, right? But man, I learned so much from them. And that helps me, from their perspectives and their life experiences, think about my own. And I think the whole Blister Enterprise is definitely better because of that, you included. You know, like beyond the first drunken moment when I misunderstood what you wanted me to do. You know, so I gain, like, my life is better and richer because of all of that. And I don't know, you know, I don't have kids. I think that helps. It's like my life is like, I wake up, I'm thinking about Blister, or I'm skiing, or I'm mountain biking, or I am trying to connect with friends and carve out time for that. Other, you know, you now running two kids, that makes it harder. You know, you're up to other things. There's other priorities, perhaps. So I'm afraid I don't have any advice in that other than, man, if you have, when great people enter your life, you better realize the value that that is and the how fortunate you are, and do your best to stay up, check in with them, ask them how they're doing. Do you have thoughts on this one? You're the busier, you're, again, with the family you're raising, like, I feel like in some ways that's eating up more of your time than mine.
I you know, I think about this a lot. And likewise, I'm fortunate to have a number of lifelong friends. I just last week booked a ski trip next year up to British Columbia with a friend of mine from that I've known since second grade. So I have a handful of friends I've known for over half my life, if not much longer.
Yeah.
And similarly, certainly don't have a formula other than, you know, I think you've got to invest time and energy in connecting with people and, you know, spending time with them. When you know, someone enters your life that you find worth doing that with. I wish I had more advice on that. But
the one thing I guess I'll say in addition is, life is busy. Like everybody is relatively busy. Some, you know, maybe some of us more busy than others, whatever. I think the biggest thing for me is one of the things I guess I think about is if shit really hit the fan and I was really in trouble in a given moment in time, my house burns down or some scenario. If you think about how many people could I call and be like, dude, it all has gone south and I'm in a real bind. How many people can you call in your life and be like, and they're like, I got you. What do you need? And I feel like I have a ton of people that I could call in that instance. And what I try to do is for my broad network of friends and people I care about, if I get that call for them, even if I can't keep up with them all, every single week in, week out, let alone day in and day out, you get that call, you better respond. And I at least try to operate with that in mind. And I think, you know, it doesn't happen all the time, but be there when those people are in their moment of need. And I think that maybe there's some of that that has then allowed some of these long-standing relationships to continue and to be rich, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, over time, you filters out the fair weather friends,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
You learn who's who you can count on. I think that's true. Well, cheers to that.
And
cheers to misinterpreting guidance on white rim skis in a drunken haze 14 years ago.
It is amazing. I love this idea now that you just wanted one article explaining reverse camber, and here's where we are. But no, man, it's been a hell of a ride, and you know, we work really hard. Our team at Blister works really hard, and I really hope people. I say that maybe a lot. Because sometimes I think people look at the outside and it's like, y'all just go ski all the time and it looks real sexy and fun. And man, there's no question there's some perks to all this. But we wouldn't be in the position we were at without gunning incredibly hard. And so shout out to our team for that. And man, this has been, yeah, what a long, strange trip it's been. And, you know, it's fun to... 14 years coming up on 14 years in to also think like we are not out of ideas. And, you know, we over the last several years have been working on sort of the next mission statement, this, you know, looking to change the culture of outdoor sports. We're all out there doing these high risk things while being underinsured or underinsured. And this to me really has got me just as excited and fired up as that original statement about, can we just give our friends in the community legit consumer product information about all of this expensive gear? Well, I'm as equally fired up on this one now. And, you know, if we've made a bit of a dent or impact on the world of outdoor sports over the last 14 years, if this is the thing that we now can affect change in, I will feel every bit as good about that, and maybe better. But you know, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We're not moving away from the original mission. We're going to keep doing that and trying to do that part better and better every single year. But we've got this other thing, and you know, if initially Blister was, we're trying to help people get the right gear, and then we've sort of say, cool, we got you in the right stuff, enjoy it out there. We now found a way to help take care of people and help them well after they picked up the gear, maybe years after they got the gear from a Blister review or emailing back and forth with one of our reviewers. So that's a cool extension of the whole mission. And again, talking about just trying to serve the community, I feel like this next mission, this second mission, is a good extension of the, are we doing things that are good for the outdoor sports community? And so far, I think, you know, I'm happy with where we are on that front. So that feels pretty good.
I think it's been far too long since we've like hung out with Mortimer the tortoise, and so I think we should go do that now.
We'll go check in.
All right. Hey, thanks to you. This was fun. A long time coming. And as you know better than anybody, you get the calls from me where I'm like, hey, I'm trying to figure out this next direction. And so I always appreciate your insight on these things. And you know, for better or for worse, you kind of are stuck with me at this point. And so I'm sure we will have a lot of strategy meetings going forward. You know, so lucky you.
Here's that.
All right, man. Thanks for this. Well, that's it for this edition of the Blister Podcast. I want to say thanks to my very good friend, Michael Clark, for this interview/conversation. Thanks to Taylor Ahern for producing this episode. And thanks very much to all of you for listening and for being such a big part of the Blister community. And when this podcast drops on Monday morning, I am certain that I will be out mountain biking here in Arizona. But then in just a couple days after that, I will be back in Crested Butte testing more backcountry ski gear and getting back on snow and on bikes back in CB. So that is my schedule. I hope you all have a terrific week, and I will talk to you again real soon.